This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. This story is from our episode about suicide. One of the things that counselors and mental health professionals learn about when they are training for this line of work is risk factors for suicide, red flags to look out for. So that sounds like detecting these warning signs means we could predict who is most likely to die by suicide. But the reality is surprising and far more complicated than that. Chad Slaman is back with this story.
Julie Bates-Maves was only a couple years out of school when she was working as a counselor at a methadone clinic. She had 89 patients, a pretty crazy caseload that happens to be par for the course in her field. Years later, though, there's one patient she thinks about almost every single day.
I remember his face vividly. I remember his typical style of dress. He had a particular coat that kind of looked like a letterman's jacket, you know, just big, bulky leather coat. And I just remember that really vividly. It was red and white and black.
She calls him Michael to protect his privacy, and she remembers that she liked him.
But he was just such a lovely person, you know, and thinking back, he was very sarcastic in his humor, and so am I. So, you know, we just kind of enjoyed being with each other. He was very vulnerable and honest about what he was experiencing.
When he first came to Julie, Michael was in pretty terrible shape. He had been working construction when he fell from the third story of a job site, breaking his back and neck. He got hooked on his narcotic pain meds and moved on to crack. All the while, the doctors never could get rid of his pain.
So it was something that was going to be chronic and persistent forever. So he came in with depression on top of his addictions, and it was all one big glob of a problem.
In the early days, it was rough going. Michael talked about hopelessness, and he talked about killing himself.
So yeah, he had a lot of the, you know, so-called traditional risk factors that we would be taught to assess for.
But Michael kept coming to every 6:30 a.m. appointment every Monday. They helped. And Michael's life outside the clinic was turning around in really big ways.
He was engaged and looking forward to many things. Marriage, just becoming a father. He was on the verge of having a workers' compensation claim paid out that would have exceeded $1 million.
Over 9 months of treatment, it seemed to Julie that Michael's life was getting better and that Michael was getting better. It had been months since he mentioned hurting himself when Monday morning came around and Michael didn't show.
I just thought he overslept because it was, you know, 6:15 in the morning. So I called and left him a voicemail saying, hey, you know, I'm sorry we missed each other. Hopefully we can just confirm our appointment for next week. Give me a call back when you can.
Michael never called back.
About 9 a.m. when I had a break and I checked my voicemail, and I had a call from his fiance saying, you know, Michael's no longer with us. I'm sorry. And that was it. And I thought, well, what?
Later, she learned that around midnight, only 6 hours before their appointment, Michael had killed himself. There's this one thing Julie repeated a lot as we talked. A client is not a friend. They can't be. It would cloud your clinical judgment, but that doesn't mean you don't care for them.
In some ways, the relationships are a step up from friendship, I guess. I mean, what I mean is that if you think about your friends, if I think about my friends, you know, there's a handful of them where I know like their deep, dark secrets and I know, you know, the reality of their insides. And then many others, I don't. I know what they show me.
It's a kind of intimacy that's hard to understand if you haven't worked in the field. She had that with Michael, and it made his death devastating. Wrapped around her grief always was the question.
You know, what went wrong? What did I miss? Oh my God, is it my fault?
Julie put herself on trial in her head, producing evidence for and against, combing through every single word she'd said, everything Michael said, examination and cross-examination constantly.
And it's just this really awful teeter-totter between tremendous guilt and then, you know, kind of counter thoughts to that of it's not your fault. But, you know, we search for explanations when things get really hard. And the easiest explanation at the time was I missed something, you know. And so every now and again, I would land on that and that would hit me like a truck.
Julie failed to predict Michael's suicide. That much was indisputable. The question that haunted her was, should she have been able to? Was there something in her counselor handbook and everything she learned in school and in clinical rotations that she could have used but didn't?
History of Mental Disorders, History of Alcohol and Substance Abuse.
These textbook risk depression. Factors, you've probably heard some of them.
Feelings of hopelessness.
I talked to psychologist Jessica Ribeiro from Florida State University about these risk factors.
I'm primarily a suicide researcher.
Her and her colleagues analyzed hundreds of longitudinal studies that represented 50 years of research. These are the type of studies that follow people for years and even decades. The researchers could see who ended up attempting a suicide or having suicidal thoughts and who didn't, and whether or not having risk factors made suicidality more likely. It turns out they didn't. Using commonly held suicide risk factors to assess people, it turns out, was as good as flipping a coin. Pure chance. Suicide science is pretty new, but still, decades of study of trying to figure out what makes someone suicidal, and we're no better at predicting that than heads or tails.
And even predictors that we thought would be particularly strong that are often cited as really strong predictors. So for instance, something like having a prior suicide attempt, that's often cited as by far the most or the strongest predictor of suicide death. Even something like that wasn't much better than chance prediction.
The most surprising risk factor that didn't actually pan out was something called clinician prediction. Even a trained professional like Julie saying this person is suicidal or not, it's still just a coin toss.
So suicide, much like everything else, like biology, for instance, is likely to be a cause of many things coming together all at once in a way that sort of defies us understanding.
The basic mystery of suicide remains what leads to it. Jessica's team's work is only a slice of a growing body of research that basically says, we don't know. Part of the reason is that suicide is incredibly difficult to study. You're always in a position where you're trying to puzzle together what happened, retrace someone's steps after the fact. You can't experimentally induce hopelessness in a group of people and see if that causes suicide. You can't randomly assign depression and watch and wait.
Traditionally, when we think about designing interventions in psychology, our strongest interventions are based on targeting those necessary causes of a phenomenon, right, and disrupting those causes. Because we don't know what the causes of suicide are, our interventions have largely been kind of flying a little blind.
So knowing just how little we know about suicide, how its causes may be too complex for humans to grasp, Jessica and her team looked to machines and to machine learning. They had access to the electronic health records of a few thousand people from Tennessee who had attempted suicide at one point. They used that data to train their algorithm to look for suicidality. It's like giving a bloodhound a whiff of a fugitive's clothing. Basically, they said, look at every characteristic these suicidal people have. Everything they've ever been diagnosed with, medical or mental, their medications, their demographics, even their socioeconomics, a bunch of factors beyond the traditional suicide-related things like whether or not they were hopeless or had some kind of addiction. Then they broaden things out. They asked the algorithm to look at the records of some 2 million people in Tennessee who had already died and to try and guess who among them had attempted suicide. And the computer was much, much better than a coin toss. It took all these factors, looked for and found patterns, and predicted correctly, suicide or not, up to 90% of the time. And the team, while they know the machine was accurate, they don't really know why.
Suicide is kind of like a painting. So like asking questions like, well, what in those particular algorithms comes out as particularly important is kind of like asking what brushstroke is the most important in painting. So what these algorithms can do is sort of capture more of that painting. So how a lot of these factors come together to create something that emerges to become suicide.
Jessica's team is working on a system that uses health records to assign a kind of score, just like blood pressure or blood sugar that doctors can track. The thing about their machine is it can't predict when a suicide will happen, tomorrow or next year. But it appears to accurately predict risk. So just like a cholesterol number can say this person needs to be on medication, this suicide risk number can say this person needs some kind of mental health intervention. But remember, Jessica and her colleagues don't understand how their machine is predicting suicide. So to try and understand the causes, they're designing the kind of experiments you can only do in virtual reality.
It's incredibly vivid.
They have a gun scenario and a tall structure jump scenario. It all looks like a video game, but it feels real.
I still have graduate students in my lab who will not jump, even though they know it's safe and they're in the lab room on solid ground and have like a ton of exposure with it.
They'll subject participants to a factor they're trying to test, say social rejection or anxiety. They'll induce that feeling and then see if the participant feels compelled to act out a suicide in the virtual reality setting. None of this is going to decode suicide all at once, but the idea is you got to start somewhere. Jessica hopes that by subjecting participants to stressors you can recreate in the lab, you can see if something pulls the rate of virtual suicide one way or another, even if it's ever so slightly. They're chipping away, experimentally, at the causes of suicide. It's basic science that hasn't really been done all that much, and it's slow.
I think we've been trying to build things because of how urgent this problem is. Like, we've been trying to build something that we hope will be helpful. But I think what the data are showing is that we really need to take a step back in the interim and really understand how this works and then build from there.
Until that happens, counselors will still face patients in crisis, and they'll have to do the best that they can with what may be an incomplete tool set. Folks like Julie, the counselor who lost a patient early in her career, tell me after many years on the job, a kind of intuition starts playing a bigger role in their assessments.
What I've learned from that experience, and certainly from Michael's death being a big part of that, is that pain is not often what it seems. And people don't have to appear sad to be hopeless. And people don't have to be depressed on the outside to be suicidal. And, you know, hopelessness is not some requisite for suicide risk.
She looks for the painting of suicide, not for individual brushstrokes.
And now it's just saying, hey, you know, here's what I'm noticing. And I can tell that you're really hurting. And I can't exactly explain to you what I'm picking up on, but I know there's something there. And I'm hoping we can talk about it.
With Michael, Julie eventually realized part of the reason she didn't see the risk is because Michael didn't want her to.
Something that I've really settled on is that when he came out of his depression, you know, a few months prior, he regained a significant amount of energy that he lacked for a long time. And sometimes you will find that to be true, that people have the energy to act now, where when they are in a depressive state, they don't always have the energy to make happen what they want to happen.
When Michael died, Julie didn't know a single other counselor who had ever lost anyone, and it's not something that's really talked about in school. It's part of what made the weeks and months after he died so torturous.
We don't want to sit with the fact that anybody could die this way any day. You know, like it's so pervasive, and yet we pretend it isn't because it's so scary.
Julie's a professor now, training future counselors. She tells each student about Michael. That way, if any of them loses a patient, and almost certainly some of them will, they'll at least know one other counselor who's been through it as well. They'll know Julie. For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.